It was hurting him in a deeper place than any vampire or werewolf would ever be able to reach. But all the same, there was such a thing as propriety. The word he didn't know. On the concept, he was very clear. Looking at them when they were looking at each other that way would be as wrong as looking at her breasts when she let go of the front of her blouse to pull Bill's T-shirt over her head. If that's the way it is. But you'll never love her the way I do. Never. Bill's T-shirt came down almost to her knees. If not for the jeans poking out from behind its hem, she would have looked as if she were wearing a short slip. Lilla, let's go, Bill repeated. I don't know about you guys, but I've had enough for one today. Turned out they all had. 11. The passage of an hour found them in the clubhouse, both the window and trap door open. It was cool inside, and the Barons was blessedly silent that day. They sat without talking much, each lost in his or her own thoughts. Richie and Bev passed a Marlboro back and forth. Eddie took a brief snort from his aspirator. Mike sneezed several times and apologized. He said he was catching a cold.
That's the only thing you could catch, Senhor,
Richie said, companionably enough, and that was all. Ben kept expecting the mad interlude in the house on Niebold Street to take on the hues of a dream. It'll recede and fall apart, he thought,
the way that bad dreams do. You wake up gasping and sweating all over, but 15 minutes later you can't remember what the dream was even about.
But that didn't happen. Everything that had happened, from the time he had forced his way in through the cellar window to the moment Bill had used the chair in the kitchen to break a window so they could get out, remained bright and clearly fixed in his memory. It had not been a dream. The clotted wound on his chest and belly was not a dream, and it didn't matter if his mom could see it or not. At last Beverly stood up.
I have to go home, she said. I want to change before my mom gets home. If she sees me wearing a boy's shirt, she'll kill me.
Kill you, Senorita, Richie agreed. But she will kill you slow.
Beep, beep, Richie.
Bill was looking at her gravely.
I'll return your shirt, Bill.
He nodded and waved a hand to show that this wasn't important.
Will you get in trouble coming home without it?
No. They hardly notice when I'm around anyway.
She nodded, bit her full underlip, a girl of 11 who was tall for her age and simply beautiful.
What happens next, Bill?
I don't know.
It's not over, is it?
Bill shook his head.
Ben said, it'll want us more than ever now.
More silver slugs? She asked him. He found he could barely stand to meet her glance.
I love you, Beverly. Just let me have that. You can have Bill or the world or whatever you need. Just let me have that. Let me go on loving you, and I guess it'll be enough.
I don't know, Ben said. We could, but... He trailed off vaguely, shrugged. He could not say what he felt was somehow not able to bring it out. That this was like being in a monster movie, but it wasn't. The mummy had looked different in some ways, ways that confirmed its essential reality. The same was true of the werewolf. He could testify to that because he had seen it in a paralyzing close-up, no film, not even one in 3D, allowed. He had had its hands in the wiry underbrush of its tangled pelt. He had seen a small, baleful orange fire spot, like a pom-pom, in one of its green eyes. These things were, well, they were dreams made real. And once dreams became real, they escaped the power of the dreamer and became their own deadly things, capable of independent action. The silver slugs had worked because the seven of them had been unified in their belief that they would. But they hadn't killed it. And next time it would approach them in a new shape, one over which silver wielded no power. Power, power, Ben thought, looking at Beverly. It was okay now. Her eyes had met Bill's again, and they were looking at each other as if lost. It was only for a moment, but to Ben it seemed very long.
It always comes back to power. I love Beverly Marsh, and she has power over me. She loves Bill Denbro, and so he has power over her. But I think... He is coming to love her. Maybe it was her face, how it looked when she said she couldn't help being a girl. Maybe it was seeing one breast for just a second. Maybe just the way she looks sometimes when the light is right, or her eyes. Doesn't matter, but if he's starting to love her, she's starting to have power over him. Superman has power, except when there's kryptonite around. Batman has power, even though he can't fly or see through walls. My mom has power over me, and her boss down in the mill has power over her. Everyone has some. Except maybe for little kids and babies. Then he thought that even little kids and babies had power. They could cry until you had to do something to shut them up.
Ben? Beverly asked, looking back at him. Cat got your tongue?
Huh?
No. I was thinking about power. The power of the slugs.
Ben was looking at him closely.
I was wondering where that power came from, Ben said.
It? Bill began and then shut his mouth. A thoughtful expression drifted over his face.
I really have to go, Beverly said. I'll see you all, huh?
Sure, come on down tomorrow, Stan said. We're going to break Eddie's other arm. They all laughed. Eddie pretended to throw his aspirator at Stan.
Bye then, Beverly said, and boosted herself up and out.
Ben looked at Bill and saw that he hadn't joined in the laughter. That thoughtful expression was still on his face, and Ben knew you would have to call his name two or three times before he would answer. He knew what Bill was thinking about. He would be thinking about it himself in the days ahead. Not all the time, no. There would be clothes to hang out and take in for his mother, games of tag and guns in the barrens, and during a rainy spell the first 4 days of August, the seven of them would go on a mad Parcheesi jag at Richie Tozier's house, making blockades, sending each other back with great abandon, deliberating exactly how to split the roll of the dice while rain dripped and ran outside. His mother would announce to him that she believed Pat Nixon was the prettiest woman in America and be horror-struck when Ben opted for Marilyn Monroe, except for the color of her hair. He thought that Bev looked like Marilyn Monroe. There would be time to eat as many Twinkies and ring-dings and devil dogs as he could get his hands on, and time to sit on the back porch reading Lucky Star and the Moons of Mercury. There would be time for all those things while the wound on his chest and belly healed to a scab and began to itch. Because life went on, and at 11, although bright and apt, he held no real sense of perspective. He could live with what had happened in the house on Niebolt Street. The world was, after all, full of wonders. But there would be odd moments of time when he pulled the questions out again and examined them. The power of the silver, the power of the slugs. Where does power like that come from? Where does any power come from? How do you get it? How do you use it? It seemed to him that their lives might depend on those questions. One night, as he was falling asleep, the rain a steady lulling patter on the roof and against the windows, it occurred to him that there was another question, perhaps the only question. It had some real shape. He had nearly seen it. To see the shape was to see the secret. Was that also true of power? Perhaps it was. For wasn't it true that power, like it, was a shape changer? It was a baby crying in the middle of the night. It was an atomic bomb. It was a silver slug. It was the way Beverly looked at Bill and the way Bill looked back. What? Exactly what was power, anyway? 12. Nothing much happened for the next 2 weeks. Derry, the fourth interlude. You've got to lose. You can't win all the time. You've got to lose. You can't win all the time. What I say? I know, pretty baby. I see trouble coming down the line. John Lee Hooker, you've got to lose. April 6th, 1985. Tell you what, friends and neighbors, I'm drunk tonight. Fuck drunk, rye whiskey. Went down to Wally's and got started. Went to the green front down on Center Street half an hour before they closed and bought a fifth of rye. I know what I'm up to. Drink cheap tonight, pay dear tomorrow. So here he sits, one drunk nigger in a public library after closing, with this book open in front of me and the bottle of Old Kentucky on my left. Tell the truth and shame the devil, my mom used to say. But she forgot to tell me that sometimes you can't shame Mr. Splitfoot Sober. The Irish know, but of course they're God's white niggers, and who knows, maybe they're a step ahead. Want to write about drink and the devil? Remember Treasure Island? The old sea dog at the Admiral Benbow? We'll do him yet, Jackie. I bet the bitter old fuck even believed it. Full of rum or rye, you can believe anything. Drink and the devil. Okay.
Amuses me sometimes to think how long I'd last if I actually published some of this stuff I write in the dead of night. If I flashed some of the skeletons in Derry's closet. There is a library board of directors, 11 of them. One is a 70-year-old writer who suffered a stroke 2 years ago and who now often needs help to find his place on each meeting's printed agenda, and who has sometimes been observed picking large dry boogers out of his hairy nostrils and placing them carefully in his ear, as if for safekeeping. Another is a pushy woman who came here from New York with her doctor husband, and who talks in a constant whiny monologue about how provincial Derry is, how no one here understands the Jewish experience, and how one has to go to Boston to buy a skirt one would care to be seen in. Last time this anorexic babe spoke to me without the services of an intermediary was during the board's Christmas party about a year and a half ago. She had consumed a pretty large amount of gin and asked me if anyone in Derry understood the black experience. I had also consumed a pretty large amount of gin and answered, "Mrs. Gladry, Jews may be a great mystery, but niggers are understood the whole world round." She choked on her drink, turned around so sharply that her panties were momentarily visible under her flaring skirt, not a very interesting view, would that it had been Carol Danner, and so ended my last informal conversation with Mrs. Ruth Gladry. No great loss. The other members of the board are the descendants of the lumber barons. Their support of the library is an act of inherited expiation. They rape the woods and now care for these books the way a libertine might decide, in his middle age, to provide for the gaily gotten bastards of his youth. It was their grandfathers and great-grandfathers who actually spread the legs of the forest north of Derry and Bangor and raped those green-gowned virgins with their axes and peavies. They cut and slashed and strip-timbered and never looked back. They tore the hymen of those great forests open when Grover Cleveland was president and had pretty well finished the job by the time Woodrow Wilson had his stroke. These lace-ruffled ruffians raped the great woods, impregnated them with a litter of slash and junk spruce, and changed Derry from a sleepy little shipbuilding town into a booming honky-tonk where the gin mills never closed and the whores turned tricks all night long. One old campaigner, Egbert Thorogood, now 93, told me of taking a slat-thin prostitute in a crib on Baker Street, a street which no longer exists. Middle-class apartment housing stands quietly where Baker Street once boiled and brawled. "I only realized after I spent my spunk in her that she was laying in a pool of jism maybe an inch deep. Stuff had just about gone to jelly. 'Girl,' I says, 'ain't you never cared for yourself?' She looks down and says, 'I'll put on a new sheet if you want to go again. There's two in the cupboard down the hall, I think. I knows pretty much what I'm laying in until 9 or 10, but by midnight my cunt's so numb it might's well be in Ellsworth.'" So that was Derry right through the first 20 or so years of the 20th century, all boom and booze and bawling. The Penobscot and the Kanduskeag were full of floating logs from ice out in April to ice in November. The business began to slack off in the 20s without the Great War or the hardwoods to feed it, and it staggered to a stop during the Depression. The lumber barons put their money in those New York or Boston banks that had survived the crash and left Derry's economy to live or die on its own. They retreated to their gracious houses on West Broadway and sent their children to private schools in New Hampshire, Massachusetts, and New York, and lived on their interest and political connections. What's left of their supremacy 70-some years after Egbert Thorogood spent his love with a dollar whore in a spermy Baker Street bed are empty wild woods in Penobscot and Aroostook counties and the great Victorian houses which stand for two blocks along West Broadway. And my library, of course. Except those good folks from West Broadway would take my library away from me in jig time. Pun definitely intended. If I published anything about the Legion of Decency, the fire at the Black Spot, the execution of the Bradley Gang, or the affair of Claude Heroux and the Silver Dollar. The Silver Dollar was a beer joint, and what may have been the queerest mass murder in the entire history of America took place there in September of 1905. There are still a few old-timers in Derry who claim to remember it, but the only account that I really trust is Thorogood's. He was 18 when it happened. Thorogood now lives in the Paulson nursing home. He's toothless, and his St. John's Valley Franco Down East accent is so thick that probably only another old Mainer could understand what he was saying if his talk were written down phonetically. Sandy Ives, the folklorist from the University of Maine, whom I have mentioned previously in these wild pages, helped me to translate my audio tapes. Claude Heroux was, according to Thorogood,
"Unbat Canuck son of a whore would nigh that had roll a Jew like a merts in de moonlight."
Translation, "One bad Canuck son of a whore with an eye that would roll at you like a mare's in the moonlight." Thorogood said that he, and everyone else who had worked with Heroux, believed the man was as sly as a chicken-stealing dog, which made his hatchet-wielding foray into the silver dollar all the more startling. It was not in character. Up until then, lumbermen and dairy had believed Heroux's talents ran more to lighting fires in the woods. The summer of 05 was long and hot, and there had been many fires in the woods, the biggest of them, which Heroux later admitted he set by simply putting a lighted candle in the middle of a pile of wood chips and kindling, happened in Haven's Big Engine Woods. It burned 20,000 acres of prime hardwood, and you could smell the smoke of it 35 miles away as the horse-drawn trolleys breasted Up Mile Hill in Derry. In the spring of that year, there had been some brief talk about unionizing. There were four lumbermen involved in organizing, not that there was much to organize. Maine working men were anti-union then and are mostly anti-union now. And one of the four was Claude Heroux, who probably saw his union activities as a chance to talk big and spend a lot of time drinking down on Baker and Exchange Streets. Heroux and the other three called themselves organizers. The lumber barons called them ringleaders. A proclamation nailed to the cook sheds in lumber camps from Monroe to Haven Village to Sumner Plantation to Millinocket informed lumbermen that any man overheard talking union would be fired off the job immediately. In May of that year, there was a brief strike up near Trapham Notch. And although the strike was broken in short order, both by scabs and by town constables, and that was rather peculiar, you understand, since there were nearly 30 town constables swinging axe handles and creasing skulls, but before that day in May, there hadn't been so much as a single constable in Trapham Notch, which had a population of 79 in the census of 1900, so far as anyone knew. Heroux and his organizing friends considered it a great victory for their cause. Accordingly, they came down to Derry to get drunk and do some more organizing, or ringleading, depending on whose side you favored. Whichever, it must have been dry work. They hit most of the bars in Hell's Half Acre, finishing up in the sleepy Silver Dollar, arms around each other's shoulders, pissing down your leg drunk, alternating union songs with pathetic tunes like "My mother's eyes are looking down from heaven," although I myself think any mother looking down from there and seeing her son in such a state might well have been excused for turning away. According to Egbert Thorogood, the only reason anyone could figure for Heroux's being in the movement at all was Davy Hartwell. Hartwell was the chief organizer, or ringleader, and Heroux was in love with him. Nor was he the only one. Most of the men in the movement loved Hartwell deeply and passionately. With that proud love men save for those of their own sex who possess a magnetism that seems to approach divinity.
"Davy Hartwell, what a man who walk like he own half of the world and had him a dela and a resp,"
Thorogood said. Translation, "Davy Hartwell was a man who walked like he owned half of the world and had him a deadlock on the rest." Heroux followed Hartwell into the organizing business the way he would have followed him if he had decided to go for a shipbuilder up in Brewer or down in Bath, or building the Seven Trestles over in Vermont, or trying to bring back the Pony Express out west, for that matter. Heroux was sly and he was mean, and I suppose that in a novel that would preclude any good qualities at all. But sometimes, when a man has spent a life being distrusted and distrustful, being a loner or a loser, both by choice and by reason of society's opinions of him, he can find a friend or a lover and simply live for that person, the way a dog lives for its master. That's the way it seems to have been between Heroux and Hartwell. Anyway, there were four of them who spent that night in the Brentwood Arms Hotel, which was then called the Floating Dog by the lumbermen. The reason why is lost in obscurity, as defunct as the hotel itself.
Four checked in. None checked out. One of them, Andy de Lesseps, was never seen again. For all history tells, he might have spent the rest of his life living in pleasant ease in Portsmouth, but somehow I doubt it. Two of the other ringleaders, Amsel Bickford and Davy Hartwell himself, were found floating face down in the Kenduskeag. Bickford was missing his head. Someone had taken it off with the swipe of a woodsman's two-hander. Both of Hartwell's legs were gone, and those who found him swore that they had never seen such an expression of pain and horror on a human face. Something had distended his mouth, stuffing out his cheeks, and when his discoverers turned him over and spread his lips, seven of his toes fell out onto the mud. Some thought he might have lost the other three during his years working in the woods. Others held the opinion that he might have swallowed them before he died. Pinned to the back of each man's shirt was a paper with the word Union on it. Claude Heroux was never brought to trial for what happened in the Silver Dollar on the night of September 9th, 1905, so there's no way of knowing exactly how he escaped the fate of the others that night in May. We could make assumptions. He had been on his own a long time, had learned how to jump fast, had perhaps developed the knack some cur dogs have of getting out just before real trouble develops. But why didn't he take Hartwell with him? Or was he perhaps taken into the woods with the rest of the agitators? Maybe they were saving him for last, and he was able to get away even while Hartwell's screams, which would have grown muffled as they jammed his toes into his mouth, were echoing in the dark and scaring birds off their roosts. There's no way of knowing, not for sure, but that last feels right to my heart. Claude Heroux became a ghost man. He would come strolling into a camp in the St. John's Valley, line up at the cook shed with the rest of the loggers, get a bowl of stew, eat it, and be gone before anyone realized he wasn't one of the topping gang. Weeks after that, he'd show up in a Winterport beer joint, talking Union and swearing he'd have his revenge on the men that had murdered his friends. Hamilton Tracker, William Mueller, and Richard Bowie were the names he mentioned the most frequently. All of them lived in Derry, and their gabled, gambrelled, cupolaed houses stand on West Broadway to this day. Years later, they and their descendants would fire the black spot. That there were people who would have liked Claude Heroux put out of the way cannot be doubted, particularly after the fires started in June of that year. But although Heroux was seen frequently, he was quick and had an animal's awareness of danger. So far as I have been able to find out, no official warrant was ever sworn out against him, and the police never took a hand. Maybe there were fears about what Heroux might say if he was brought to trial for arson. Whatever the reasons, the woods around Derry and Haven burned all that hot summer. Children disappeared, there were more fights and murders than usual, and a pall of fear as real as the smoke you could smell from the top of Upmile Hill lay over the town. The rains finally came on September 1st, and it rained for a solid week. Downtown Derry was flooded out, which was not unusual, but the big houses on West Broadway were high above downtown, and in some of those big houses there must have been sighs of relief. Let the crazy Canuck hide out in the woods all winter, if that's what he wants, they might have said. His work's done for this summer, and we'll get him before the roots dry next June. Then came September 9th. I cannot explain what happened. Thorogood cannot explain it. So far as I know, no one can. I can only relate the events which occurred. The sleepy Silver Dollar was full of loggers drinking beer. Outside, it was drawing down toward misty dark. The Kenduskeag was high and silver sullen, filling its channel from bank to bank, and according to Egbert Thorogood,
a foolish wind was blowing, the kind that always find the hole in your paints and blow straight up a crack of your ace.
The streets were quagmires. There was a card game going on at one of the tables in the back of the room. They were William Mueller's men. Mueller was part owner of the GS and WM rail line, as well as a lumber potentate who owned millions of acres of prime timber, and the men who were playing poker in the dollar that night were part-time lumbermen, part-time railroad bulls, and full-time trouble. Two of them, Tinker McCutcheon and Floyd Calderwood, had done jail time. With them were Lathrop Rounds. His nickname, as obscure as the Floating Dog Hotel, was El Katuk. Dave Stugley Grenier, and Eddie King, a bearded man whose spectacles were almost as fat as his gut.
It seems very likely that they were at least some of the men who had spent the last 2.5 months keeping an eye out for Claude Heroux. It seems just as likely, although there is not a shred of proof, that they were in on the little cutting party in May when Hartwell and Bickford were laid low. The bar was crowded, Thorogood said. Dozens of men were bellied up there, drinking beer and eating bar lunches and dripping onto the sawdust-covered dirt floor. The door opened, and in came Claude Heroux. He had a woodsman's double-bitted axe in his hand. He stepped up to the bar and elbowed himself a place. Egbert Thorogood was standing on his left. He said that Heroux smelled like a polecat stew. The barman brought Heroux a schooner of beer, 2 hard-cooked eggs in a bowl, and a shaker of salt. Heroux paid him with a $2 bill and put his change, $1.85, into one of the flap pockets of his lumberman's jacket. He salted his eggs and ate them. He salted his beer, drank it off, and uttered a belch.
"More room out there than there is in, Claude," Thorogood said, just as if half the enforcers in northern Maine hadn't been on the prod for Heroux all that summer.
"You know that's the truth," Heroux said, except being a Canuck. What he probably said came out sounding more like, "You know that the truth." He ordered himself another schooner, drank up, and belched again. Talk at the bar went on. Several people called to Claude, and Claude nodded and waved, but he didn't smile. Thorogood said he looked like a man who was half in a dream. At the table in back, the poker game went on. Elka Took was dealing. No one bothered to tell any of the players that Claude Heroux was in the bar, although, since their table was no more than 20 feet away, and since Claude's name was hollered more than once by people who knew him, it is hard to know how they could have gone on playing, unaware of his potentially murderous presence. But that is what occurred. After he finished his second schooner of beer, Heroux excused himself to Thorogood, picked up his two-hander, and went back to the table where Mueller's men were playing 5-card stud. Then he started cutting. Floyd Calderwood had just poured himself a glass of rye whiskey and was setting the bottle back down when Heroux arrived and chopped Calderwood's hand off at the wrist. Calderwood looked at his hand and screamed. It was still holding the bottle, but all of a sudden wasn't attached to anything but wet gristle and trailing veins. For a moment, the severed hand clutched the bottle even tighter, and then it fell off and lay on the table like a dead spider. Blood spouted from his wrist. At the bar, somebody called for more beer, and someone else asked the bartender, whose name was Jonesy, if he was still dyeing his hair. "Never dyed it," Jonesy said in an ill-tempered way. He was vain of his hair. "Met a whore down at Ma Courtney's who said what grows around your pecker is just as white as snow," the fellow said. "She was a liar," Jonesy replied. "Drop your pants and let's us see," said a lumberman named Falkland, with whom Egbert Thorogood had been matching for drinks before Heroux came in. This provoked general laughter. Behind them, Floyd Calderwood was shrieking. A few of the men leaning against the bar took a casual look around in time to see Claude Heroux bury his woodsman's axe in Tinker McCutcheon's head. Tinker was a big man with a black beard going gray. He got halfway up, blood pouring down his face, then sat down again. Heroux pulled the axe out of his head. Tinker started to get up again, and Heroux slung the axe sideways, burying it in his back. It made a sound, Thorogood said, like a load of laundry being dropped on a rug. Tinker flopped over the table, his card spraying out of his hand. The other players were hollering and bellowing. Calderwood, still shrieking, was trying to pick up his right hand with his left as his life's blood ran out of his stump of a wrist in a steady stream. Stugley Grenier had what Thorogood called a clutch pistol, meaning a gun in a shoulder holster, and he was grabbing for it with no success whatsoever. Eddie King tried to get up and fell right out of his chair on his back. Before he could get up, Heroux was standing astride him, the axe slung up over his head. King screamed and held up both hands in a warding-off gesture. "Please, Claude, I just got married last month," King screamed. The axe came down, its head almost disappearing in King's ample gut. Blood sprayed all the way to the dollar's beamed roof. Eddie began to crawfish on the floor. Claude pulled the axe out of him the way a good woodsman will pull his axe out of a softwood tree, kind of rocking it back and forth to loosen the clinging grip of the sappy wood. When it was free, he slung it up over his head. He brought it down again, and Eddie King stopped screaming. Claude Heroux wasn't done with him, however. He began to chop King up like kindling wood. At the bar, conversation had turned to what sort of winter lay ahead. Vernon Stanchfield, a farmer from Palmyra, claimed it would be a mild one. Fall rain uses up winter snow, was his scripture. Alfie Nogler, who had a farm out on the Nogler Road in Derry, it is gone now, where Alfie Nogler once grew his peas and beans and beets, the interstate extension now runs its 8.8-mile, six-lane course, begged to disagree. Alfie claimed the coming winter was going to be a geezer. He had seen as many as 8 rings on some of the mohair caterpillars, he said, an unheard-of number. Another man held out for ice, another for mud. The blizzard of 01 was duly recalled. Jonesy sent schooners of beer and bowls of hard-cooked eggs skidding down the bar. Behind them, the screaming went on and the blood flowed in rivers. At this point in my questioning of Egbert Thorogood, I turned off my cassette recorder and asked him, "How did it happen? Are you saying you didn't know it was going on, or that you knew but you let it go on, or just what?" Thorogood's chin sank down to the top button of his food-spotted vest. His eyebrows drew together. The silence in Thorogood's room, small, cramped, and medicinal-smelling, spun out so long that I was about to repeat my question when he replied,
"We knew, but it didn't seem to matter. It was like politics, in a way. Yeah, like that. Like town business. Best let people who understand politics take care of that, and people who understand town business take care of that. Such things be best done if working men don't mix in."
"Are you really talking about fate and just afraid to come out and say so?" I asked suddenly. The question was simply jerked out of me, and I certainly did not expect Thorogood, who was old and slow and unlettered, to answer it. But he did, with no surprise at all.
"Yeah," he said, "mayhap I am."
While the men at the bar went on talking about the weather, Claude Heroux went on cutting. Stugly Grenier had finally managed to clear his clutch pistol. The axe was descending for another chop at Eddie King, who was by then in pieces. The bullet Grenier fired struck the head of the axe and ricocheted off with a spark and a whine. Elka Took got to his feet and started backing away. He was still holding the deck he had been dealing from. Cards were fluttering off the bottom and onto the floor. Claude came after him. Elka Took held out his hands. Stugly Grenier got off another round, which didn't come within 10 feet of Heroux.
"Stop, Claude," Elka Took said.
Thorogood said it appeared like Katook was trying to smile.
"I wasn't with them. I didn't mix in at all."
Heroux only growled.
"I was in Millinocket,"
Elka Took said, his voice starting to rise toward a scream.
"I was in Millinocket. I swear it on my mother's name. Ask anybody if you don't believe me."
Claude raised the dripping axe, and Elka Took sprayed the rest of the cards into his face. The axe came down, whistling. Elka Took ducked. The axe had buried itself in the planking that formed the Silver Dollar's back wall. Elka Took tried to run. Claude hauled the axe out of the wall and poked it between his ankles. Elka Took went sprawling. Stugly Grenier shot at Heroux again, this time having a bit more luck. He had been aiming at the crazed lumberman's head. The bullet struck home in the fleshy part of Heroux's thigh. Meantime, Elka Took was crawling busily toward the door with his hair hanging in his face. Heroux swung the axe again, snarling and gibbering, and a moment later, Katook's severed head was rolling across the sawdust-strewn floor. The tongue popped bizarrely out between the teeth. It rolled to a stop by the booted foot of a lumberman named Varney, who had spent most of the day in the Dollar and who, by then, was so exquisitely slopped that he didn't know if he was on land or at sea. He kicked the head away without looking down to see what it was and hollered for Jonesy to run him down another beer. Elka Took crawled another 3 feet, blood spraying from his neck in a high-tension jet, before he realized he was dead and collapsed. That left Stugly. Heroux turned on him, but Stugly had run into the outhouse and locked the door. Heroux chopped his way in, hollering and blabbering and raving, slobber falling from his jaws. When he got in, Stugly was gone, although the cold, leaky little room was windowless. Heroux stood there for a moment, head lowered, powerful arms slimed and splattered with blood, and then, with a roar, he flipped up the lid of the three-holer. He was just in time to see Stugly's boots disappearing under the ragged board skirting of the outhouse wall. Stugly Grenier ran screaming down Exchange Street in the rain, beshitted from top to toe, crying that he was being murdered. He survived the cutting party in the Silver Dollar. He was the only one who did. But after 3 months of listening to jokes about his method of escape, he quitted the dairy area forever. Hero stepped out of the toilet and stood in front of it like a bull after a charge, head down, his axe held in front of him. He was puffing and blowing and covered with gore from head to foot.
"Shut the door, Claude. That shit pot stinks to high heaven," Thorogood said.
Claude dropped his axe on the floor and did as he had been asked. He walked over to the card-strewn table where his victims had been sitting, kicking one of Eddie King's severed legs out of his way. Then he simply sat down and put his head in his arms. The drinking and conversation at the bar went on. 5 minutes later, more men began to pile in, 3 or 4 sheriff's deputies among them. The one in charge was Lal Machen's father, and when he saw the mess, he had a heart attack and had to be taken away to Dr. Schratt's office. Claude Heroux was led away. He was docile when they took him, more asleep than awake. That night, the bars all up and down Exchange and Baker Streets boomed and hollered with the news of the slaughter. A righteous, drunken sort of fury began to build up, and when the bars closed, better than 70 men headed downtown toward the jail and the courthouse. They had torches and lanterns. Some were carrying guns, some had axes, some had peavies. The county sheriff wasn't due from Bangor until the noon stage the next day, so he wasn't there, and Goose Machen was laid up in Dr. Schratt's infirmary with his heart attack. The two deputies who were sitting in the office playing cribbage heard the mob coming and got out of there fast. The drunks broke in and dragged Claude Heroux out of his cell. He didn't protest much. He seemed dazed, vacant. They carried him on their shoulders like a football hero. Down to Canal Street they carried him, and there they lynched him from an old elm that overhung the canal. He was so far gone that he didn't kick but twice, Egbert Thorogood said. It was, so far as the town records show, the only lynching to ever take place in this part of Maine. And, almost needless to say, it was not reported in the Derry News. Many of those who had gone on drinking unconcernedly while Heroux went about his business in the Silver Dollar were in the necktie party that strung him up. By midnight, their mood had changed. I asked Thorogood my final question. Had he seen anyone he didn't know during that day's violence? Someone who struck him as strange, out of place, funny, even clownish. Someone who would have been drinking at the bar that afternoon. Someone who had maybe turned into one of the rabble-rousers that night as the drinking went on and the talk turned to lynching?
Mayhap there was, Thorogood replied.
He was tired by then, drooping, ready for his afternoon nap.
It were a long time ago, mister. Long and long.
But you remember something, I said.
I remember thinking that there must be a county fair up Bangor way, Thorogood said. I was having a beer in the Bloody Bucket that night. The Bucket was about 6 doors from the Silver Dollar. There was a fella in there, comical sort of fella, doing flips and rollovers, juggling glasses, tricks. Put 4 dimes on his forehead and they'd stay right there. Comical, you know.
His bony chin had sunk to his chest again. He was going to sleep right in front of me. Spittle began to bubble at the corners of his mouth, which had as many tucks and wrinkles as a lady's change purse.
Seen him a few now and then since, Thorogood said. Figure maybe he had such a good time that night that he decided to stick around.
Yeah, he's been around a long time, I said. His only response was a weak snore. Thorogood had gone to sleep in his chair by the window, with his medicines and nostrums lined up beside him on the sill, soldiers of old age at muster. I turned off my tape recorder and just sat looking at him for a moment, this strange time traveler from the year 1890 or so, who remembered when there were no cars, no electric lights, no airplanes, no state of Arizona. Pennywise had been there, guiding them down the path toward another gaudy sacrifice, just one more in Derry's long history of gaudy sacrifices. That one, in September of 1905, ushered in a heightened period of terror that would include the Eastertide explosion of the Kitchener Ironworks the following year. This raises some interesting, and for all I know, vitally important, questions. What does it really eat, for instance? I know that some of the children have been partially eaten. They show bite marks, at least. But perhaps it is we who drive it to do that.
Certainly we have all been taught since earliest childhood that what the monster does when it catches you in the deep wood is eat you. That is perhaps the worst thing we can conceive. But it's really faith that monsters live on, isn't it? I am led irresistibly to this conclusion. Food may be life, but the source of power is faith, not food. And who is more capable of a total act of faith than a child? But there's a problem. Kids grow up. In the church, power is perpetuated and renewed by periodic ritualistic acts. In Derry, power seems to be perpetuated and renewed by periodic ritualistic acts, too. Can it be that it protects itself by the simple fact that, as the children grow into adults, they become either incapable of faith or crippled by a sort of spiritual and imaginative arthritis? Yes, I think that's the secret here. And if I make the calls, how much will they remember? How much will they believe? Enough to end this horror once and for all, or only enough to get them killed? They are being called, I know that much. Each murder in this new cycle has been a call. We almost killed it twice, and in the end, we drove it deep in its warren of tunnels and stinking rooms under the city. But I think it knows another secret. Although it may be immortal, or almost so, we are not. It had only to wait until the act of faith, which made us potential monster killers as well as sources of power, had become impossible. 27 years. Perhaps a period of sleep for it, as short and refreshing as an afternoon nap would be for us. And when it awakes, it is the same, but a third of our lives has gone by. Our perspectives have narrowed. Our faith in the magic, which makes magic possible, has worn off like the shine on a new pair of shoes after a hard day's walking. Why call us back? Why not just let us die? Because we nearly killed it? Because we frightened it, I think? Because it wants revenge. And now that we no longer believe in Santa Claus, the Tooth Fairy, Hansel and Gretel, or the troll under the bridge, it is ready for us. Come on back, it says. Come on back. Let's finish our business in Derry. Bring your jacks and your marbles and your yo-yos. We'll play. Come on back, and we'll see if you remember the simplest thing of all. How it is to be children. Secure in belief, and thus afraid of the dark. On that one, at least, I score 1,000%. I am frightened. So goddamn frightened. End of side 23.